This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour. It's coming to you live from the BBC World Service. I'm Tim Franks. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been at the top of politics for decades. But very shortly, we're expecting him to go into the most crucial international meeting he's ever had. Not my verdict, but that of one of the people you're about to hear from. The meeting is with Donald Trump in the White House. It's due to start within the next few minutes. Mr. Netanyahu has said that being the first foreign leader to be welcomed at the start of President Trump's second term of office shows how close the bond is between the two countries and the two men. But the question is that really so? How far are the two men's agendas in alignment? Over Gaza, over the long-term future for the Palestinians, over the price of a possible Israeli rapprochement with Saudi Arabia, over what to do about Iran's nuclear programme. In a moment, we'll get an Israeli and an American perspective. First, Steve Witkoff, who's Mr. Trump's special envoy to the Middle East, spoke an hour or so ago to reporters about one of the president's more controversial ideas, to move Gazans out of Gaza while the territory is rebuilt.
In any city in the United States of America, if you had damage that was 1/100th of what I saw in Gaza, and I went there at the direction of the president and the national security advisor, nobody would be allowed to go back to their homes. That's how dangerous it is. There's 30,000 unexploded munitions, buildings that could tip over at any moment. There's no utilities there whatsoever. No working water, electric, gas, nothing. God knows what kind of disease might be festering there. So when the president talks about cleaning it out, he talks about making it habitable. And this is a long-range plan. It is unfair to have explained to Palestinians that they might be back in 5 years. That's just preposterous.
Well, joining us now from the White House, our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman. Tom, we heard pretty blunt language from Steve Witkoff. We've heard it within the last hour or so from Mr. Trump pushing this idea. It's enormously controversial in the region, but it seems to be something that the administration doesn't want to walk away from.
Yeah, I mean, this started about 10 days ago with what appeared to be an off-the-cuff comment from Mr. Trump about Palestinians being taken, as he put it, by Jordan and Egypt because, and similar to what you heard from Steve Witkoff, he described Gaza as a demolition site. I mean, incidentally, a demolition site because of the damage of, you know, overwhelmingly American munitions. But that is the argument that the Americans are now making, or the administration is now making, that up to 2 million Palestinians would have to be, in their language, relocated from Gaza. They're sort of framing this as a humanitarian gesture while it's rebuilt. But of course, to the Arab world and to Palestinians, this would be nothing short of forcible displacement, expulsion. And in the historical context of the Israeli-Palestinian context, that is absolutely profound, of course, because this is a population already once displaced from their homes historically in what was what became Israel. That is why the Arab world is up in arms about even the very suggestion of this, a statement from Arab leaders over the weekend utterly rejecting it and saying this would only create more instability and conflict in the region.
And Tom, both as State Department correspondent and your former role as Middle East correspondent, the two men most immediately have to discuss, Netanyahu and Trump, how the next phase of the Gaza ceasefire is going to proceed. How tough do you think those talks are going to be?
Well, I think they are going to be tough because there's not a, you know, where this situation is at now is we're halfway through phase one of hostage release and ceasefire, nearly halfway through. As hard as it was to get to that point, it is potentially even tougher to get to the second phase because that means a permanent end to the war, i.e. a full Israeli withdrawal from Gaza and the release of the rest of the hostages. Now, Mr. Netanyahu has made clear he doesn't want a complete end until Hamas is gone from Gaza, completely destroyed. I think for Mr. Trump, he basically wants the thing done so that he can move on with what he sees as his big deal for the region, and that's normalization between Saudi Arabia and Israel. So I think already you'll see the tension points emerge from these talks.
Tom Bateman in Washington, thanks very much indeed. Aviv Bushinsky has worked as chief of staff and spokesman for Benjamin Netanyahu. He's the man I mentioned who said this was the Israeli Prime Minister's biggest meeting he's ever had. Why so?
I think it will determine his political future, his legacy, and the future of Israel. Either the U.S. administration would enable Netanyahu to fulfill his promise to the people in Israel, which is dismantling the Hamas and winning the war. He claims that he can even reach an ultimate victory. And of course, the other elements, which is the normalization with Saudi Arabia, implementing the hostages deal, and the Iranian threat, which is also an imminent threat that perhaps Israel needs the U.S. Help. And so, yes, I think that Netanyahu also in a more complex situation, because Trump will not receive no for an answer.
Do you think in that case, Aviv, it's clear to Mr. Netanyahu exactly what Mr. Trump wants? I mean, Trump says he wants the war over, but does Netanyahu know on exactly what terms?
I think that Netanyahu cannot afford saying no to President Trump, assuming that Trump wants to complete the deal. And even if it will cost taking the eliminating the Hamas longer than expected. So Netanyahu cannot say no to Trump, unlike when he did say no to President Clinton while implementing the Oslo Accord. He said no to Obama when he had the nuclear deal with Iran. But here Netanyahu cannot say no to Trump, which is being perceived as his best friend and ally and the most favorite administration that any Israeli could dream of.
So let's run the tape on this and say that Mr. Trump and Mr. Netanyahu agree that the war must be brought to a close. In order for all the hostages to be released, he will need to free thousands of Palestinian prisoners, some of whom are regarded in Israel as very high value. They will be loath to see them be released. Can Netanyahu survive?
If Netanyahu will come back from Washington, implementing the entire deal with the Hamas, but pulling out all the forces from Gaza without toppling the Hamas, I think this coalition will not last long, and then Netanyahu will have to decide. Either he ends his career and go back with saying, okay, I brought peace with Saudi Arabia, maybe I've managed to do something against Iran, or try to convince the people in Israel and go to another elections. That's why I'm saying that this meeting is maybe the most crucial meeting that Netanyahu ever had.
Gaza is one thing, and then there is the talk about whether Donald Trump is going to offer Mr. Netanyahu a way forward towards normalization with Saudi Arabia, which would be a huge diplomatic prize, and possibly offering him something about trying to put Iran back in its box over its nuclear ambitions. Those two things are, by their very nature, they're going to be longer term issues. They won't be prizes that he can wave in front of some of his more hardline colleagues.
The billion-dollar question is not necessarily the normalization or the peace, is what will be the price? Will Israel agree to a future Palestinian state? And Netanyahu cannot afford agreeing to that. I think the people in Israel in general after October 7th are not ripe even to talk about the Palestinian state. They say this will be a price for terror. So if this will be part of the equation, I don't think that Netanyahu will go all the way. And then there won't be a normalization with Saudi Arabia. If you want me to try and guess what will be the outcome of the meeting tonight, so yes, we will try to go to the second phase, implementing the deal with the Hamas, pulling out from Gaza, and getting some kind of affirmation from the U.S. administration saying, we see eye to eye, and when time comes, we'll get rid of the Hamas. I think that this will be the outcome. The rest is quite vague.
Aviv Bushinsky. Jonathan Panikoff was the U.S. Deputy National Intelligence Officer for the Near East during Donald Trump's first term in office. How far does he think the two men really do have something in common?
I think they're coming at this from two different desires of what they're trying to get out of it. For Trump, this is really about reestablishing that Netanyahu should not try to treat him as he treated President Biden, or frankly, Trump, who we know is very transactional, is not going to be there to support him in the ways that Netanyahu fundamentally needs, not only related to Gaza, but related to Iran. For Netanyahu, this is about, as your previous guest said, about Gaza and the second phase and setting the stage and making clear to President Trump that, look, if there's not a real security plan in place that's going to ensure Israel's security, then Israel's going to have a hard time actually agreeing to a second phase because it's going to be worrisome that they're not going to accomplish the goals that Netanyahu has set at the beginning. And secondly, that Iran still remains a big question and whether Netanyahu can convince Trump to work with him in terms of going after Iran, I think in a more aggressive way that many hawks have traditionally wanted, but many in the Trump administration in the more isolationist wing are no longer interested in doing.
Do you think it's also, in a way, about how they do politics? Because Mr. Trump has suggested from some of his language that he is a bit impatient to see all this sorted. In contrast, Mr. Netanyahu has, you know, partly survived for so long by being a magician in terms of sort of making things disappear, pushing them off into the far distance.
I think that's absolutely true. For President Trump, his goal, quite literally, is to help remake the Middle East and in doing so, frankly, be heralded for the peacemaking ability that he was able to bring that no one else did. And I think he'd like to seriously win a Nobel Prize for it. I think that the challenge is for Prime Minister Netanyahu, in order to keep going on the second phase, the third phase of this hostage agreement, in order to have the type of deal that Trump may want with Iran, that's going to cost him a lot of his support among the right. And so politically, that's going to be untenable for him because even if Benny Gantz, the former defense minister, or Lapid, the opposition leader, were to come in to temporarily support the coalition, it wouldn't last. They all want to see Netanyahu out of office as soon as possible. So their political motivations are not at all in line.
Jonathan, just one more question. And it is about what we've heard today from Steve Witkoff, but also Donald Trump within the last few minutes has been doubling down on this business of, look, Palestinians, in his words, would love to leave Gaza. They have no alternative but to leave Gaza because the place is destroyed and he'd like to see Jordan and Egypt take them in. Do you think the administration is in earnest about this?
Well, I think President Trump is in earnest about it. I think it's worth remembering that in the first term, President Trump actually tried to convince Jordan at the time to take much or all of some of the Palestinian territories in the West Bank. Eventually, through great efforts by King Abdullah, who's going to be in Washington next week to meet with him, that petered out. You didn't hear a lot about it. There was a formal plan presented that didn't go anywhere. My sense is President Trump is earnest. I think, obviously, that's anathema to both Jordan and Egypt. It would undermine both of their stability. They would be very concerned about, rightly so. So I can't imagine it going anywhere.
Jonathan Panikoff. This is NewsHour. And coming up on the program, we'll be meeting some of the people evacuating civilians from the front lines of the war in Ukraine.
We're going to Pokrovsk. The city is basically on the front line. It's been heavily attacked day and night. There are around 7,000 people still in the city. So we'll try to get some people out of that nightmare.
That report is coming up in about 30 minutes. Our headlines this hour, the Swedish authorities say that 10 people have died in a gun attack on a college campus. The gunman is among those who are dead. We'll get the latest on that in 15 minutes. And as we've been hearing, Donald Trump and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu are due to begin meeting shortly at the White House. They'll be discussing the Gaza ceasefire and other matters across the Middle East. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC with me, Tim Franks. Lucy Letby is one of Britain's most notorious serial killers, convicted of the murder of 7 babies and attempting to murder 7 others when she was a nurse at a neonatal unit of a hospital in northwest England. She was sentenced to a whole life prison sentence, life in prison without the prospect of parole, in other words, back in 2023. The question raised today, louder than at any time since her trial, is she innocent? A panel of 14 international medical experts announced today that they have grave doubts over the evidence used to convict Letby. Their news conference in Westminster was chaired by the senior British lawmaker, David Davis.
Dr. Lee and his team have done all of this pro bono, all of this entirely out of the good of their heart, and he's come here today, I suspect at his own expense, to address this issue and put right what I think, anyway, is one of the major injustices of modern times.
The Dr. Lee, whom David Davis referred to, is Professor Shu Lee. He co-authored a 1989 academic paper on air embolism in babies. It was referred to in Letby's trial, and he led the team of neonatal and paediatric specialists who re-examined the cases of all 17 babies. Letby was sentenced for murdering or for harming.
In summary, ladies and gentlemen, we did not find any murders. In all cases, death or injury were due to natural causes or just bad medical care. Lucy was charged with 7 murders and 7 attempted murders. In our opinion, the medical evidence doesn't support murder in any of these babies, just natural causes and bad medical care. Our full report will go to Lucy's barrister later this month, and then it'll be up to him in the courts.
That was Dr. Lee speaking, Shu Lee speaking at this news conference. So how striking has today's intervention been? Tom Simons is our correspondent covering the case.
I think it's the most concerted effort to overturn the conviction that we've seen to date. 14 eminent medical experts from around the world. And what they've done is they've analysed evidence that was in front of previous cases, in particular the trials, and they've said, are there alternative explanations for the deaths of these babies? And in every case, they say there is a fairly clear alternative explanation. That is all going to go to the Criminal Cases Review Commission, which reviews cases where there are concerns. If the CCRC decides, then there would be an appeal. And if the appeal court decides that she should be, that the conviction should be quashed, then that might happen. But it's all a very long way away.
Right. So just to be clear about the potential process, this Criminal Case Review Commission might recommend to the Court of Appeal or order the Court of Appeal?
Recommend to the Court of Appeal right. that it reopen the case, and the Court of Appeal generally does. And what the CCRC is going to want to have in front of it is new evidence. And that's where I think this might be tricky for Lucy Letby's defence team, because what they've got is a reanalysis of existing evidence, which they would say is new expert evidence. They say this has been looked at properly for the first time. It wasn't looked at properly in the original trial. And that because we've looked at it properly and we've come up with alternatives, that is new evidence.
It seems astonishing that you're saying that it wasn't looked at, or they're saying it wasn't looked at properly in the original trial. I mean, is that, if that is the case, is the problem with the defence in that case? Or, I mean, presumably not with the prosecution.
So, exactly. It is most likely the fault of the defence. So, part of the evidence was about babies being injected with air. A number of babies died in that way. And part of the expert evidence came from Dr. Shu Lee, a neonatal doctor retired from Canada. He wasn't called to give evidence about that, but his research was used as part of the case. Now, he says, by the prosecution, now he says it was wrongly used, because what it actually shows is that it couldn't have been Lucy Letby injecting a baby with air because of the various signs on the baby's body couldn't have fitted with an injection of air. So when it came to the appeals, he attempted to have his evidence called as part of the appeal and actually didn't succeed. So that's the kind of thing. And in many other cases, in other types of medical analysis, the defence team is saying this was not part of the original trial and it should have been.
There's immense interest in this case. I mean, not just in the UK, but around the world. I mean, partly because, of course, this was a serial killer who killed lots of babies, was accused of trying to kill other babies, and the serial killer is a woman, which is rare. Beyond that, Tom, how much do you think this case potentially matters for how the English criminal justice system is viewed?
I think it's high stakes in lots of different ways. First of all, clearly the families involved. It's really, really difficult for them, first of all. Secondly, if a big criminal trial like this, an 8-month trial, followed by a retrial, followed by an attempt to appeal, has been based on shaky evidence, then clearly that's going to be a major problem for the courts. The prosecution are going to come under scrutiny. And then finally, of course, if Lucy Letby didn't kill these children, then the NHS is likely to have failed quite catastrophically
in lots of different ways.
One particular hospital. And so if that is the outcome, then there are going to be many questions to answer there. It opens a number of Pandora's boxes today, and we will have to see where this goes.
One of our correspondents, Tom Simons, on the latest developments over Lucy Letby. A brief dip into today's tariff news. China has retaliated against new taxes ordered by Donald Trump on Chinese imports. Beijing has said it will introduce its own range of tariffs. But on the US's borders, north and south, there's been a cautious sigh of relief over the president's decision to suspend for 1 month the imposition of tariffs on Mexico and Canada while they try to shore up border security. David McGuinty is Canada's Minister of Public Safety and has partial responsibility for that border. My colleague Paul Henley asked him whether there is any more clarity now over exactly what Donald Trump wants.
When we set out to address these concerns raised by the president when he was first elected in his administration, we set out to stop any imposition of tariff. I think we succeeded in doing so. Yesterday for now, we have a 30-day reprieve, but we're working now to make some significant further investments in our border, particularly as it deals with the question, the tragedy, the scourge of fentanyl. Our objective remains the same, which is to not have tariffs on either of our economies.
What are you making of the repeated talk from President Trump of Canada becoming the 51st American state?
Well, Canadians would say that they beg to differ. That's not on. We're going to move forward and manage this relationship as best we can, as we have been doing for 150 years. This is the world's longest undefended border. It's something that we prize. It's something that we cherish. And so we're going to continue to manage that relationship. And, you know, it's important for listeners to also recall less than 1% of the fentanyl entering the United States is coming from Canada. In the last 12-month period, 43 pounds was seized at the American border coming from Canada. 21,000 pounds were seized coming from the southern border into the United States. So we're going to continue to work together. We've got partnerships at different levels, and we're going to, I'm convinced, find our way forward on this one.
And given Trump's unpredictability, how worried are you now that companies thinking of investing or upgrading in Canada may just decide not to?
It's a concern, but I think as we work together and build a relationship with the new administration, we have a choice to make in both of our countries, which is, do we want a win-win proposition or a lose-lose proposition? And I think most people in the United States would rather see a win. They understand the degree of interconnectedness, and I think we're going to have to just simply redouble our efforts to manage that relationship well.
Welcome back to NewsHour. A year ago, few people had heard of Mikey Madison. Now she's been nominated for Best Actress at the Golden Globes, the BAFTAs and the Oscars, thanks to her acclaimed performance in the film Anora. Our correspondent, Lizo Mazimba, caught up with her.
Do you want to get married to me, Vanya? You want me to be your little wifey?
The film starts out feeling like a fairy tale for Anora.
I do.
A stripper turned sex worker, she marries the son of a Russian oligarch. But Anora, Annie to her friends, finds not everyone is happy about it.
This is not a real marriage. We're getting in annulled and you have no say in it.
Annie is an incredible blend of both fragility and strength. As an actor, you must love being able to play those extremes.
She's a very complicated character, very nuanced. I always felt that she was someone who was very vulnerable on the inside, but is constantly covering it up with this hardness or an aggression.
Your cousin doesn't start showing us some respect? We're not going to tip out anymore.
All right, yeah. I'll talk to him.
The film and the performance from the relatively unknown Mikey Madison have been gaining huge amounts of awards momentum, something that started when it premiered at Cannes.
I've been working for almost a decade now we're trying to work, and that was my ultimate dream, to go to Cannes, and we had a film in the main competition, and then we won, and that was crazy in itself and amazing. And so I don't know, I mean, I think everything that has followed has been An absolutely wonderful, pleasant surprise.
What is it like having this kind of success with the film? What's going through your head with all that?
I think I'm just processing it. I know that I'm incredibly overjoyed, honored, and humbled that our film is being recognized in this way. It's overwhelming and amazing and all of the things.
I can speak Russian. I just prefer not to, but you can go ahead and speak Russian. I'll understand.
I don't understand.
Mikey Madison's portrayal of the role is currently making her one of Hollywood's most talked about young actors. The writer and director of the film, Sean Baker, had seen her on screen before and wrote the part of Annie especially for her.
She's so unique in not only her physicality, but there's something about her aura. There's something about... She's actually quite subdued. But then suddenly she can explode like no other person I've ever seen, like no other actor I've ever seen. It was incredible to watch.
As an actor, I felt like I was shooting a very romantic film, and sometimes it was like almost like a horror film or a drama or a slapstick comedy. And to navigate through my character with all of those different genres was fun. It was a challenge, and I liked it.
She's been BAFTA-nominated and Oscar-nominated, which means 2025 could be an extraordinary breakthrough year.
I like Anora.
The Mikey Madison.
It's a good name.
And that was Lizo Mazimba speaking to Mikey Madison. You're with NewsHour. It's live from the BBC World Service. I'm Tim Franks. In Sweden, at least 10 people have been killed in a shooting on an education campus in the central city of Örebro. The Swedish Prime Minister has said it's the worst mass shooting in his country's history. The police have told us the gunman's among the dead and he acted alone. They say his motive remains unclear at the moment and he didn't appear to have any connection to a gang. He was, in their words, unknown to them. The shooting happened at a college for adults, but there are also schools for children on the campus. A video on social media appears to show the attack underway. It's filmed from a balcony. You'll hear a woman first say, "The man is standing over there without a jacket," and then shots rip through the air. Oh my God, there's been a shooting, she shouts. Johannes Sjöberg's daughter was at the college where the attack took place. He told Swedish television he'd been in touch with her throughout.
It was very moving and difficult at the beginning, and easy to cry for the first hour and a half. But now I'm feeling calmer. According to my daughter, the perpetrator has committed suicide. Whether or not that's true, I don't know, but that's what she said. She seemed blood and misery in there, and many of the students have panicked. So it's been a horrible experience.
Jonas Klaassen is head of health services in the Örebro region. How many casualties have they been dealing with?
We've admitted 6 patients to the hospital, 5 of them with gunshot wounds. Of the 5 that received gunfire, 4 have been admitted for surgery. And they all have major injuries. One of them have sustained life-threatening injuries.
The attack unfolded through the afternoon. Obviously, it was difficult for the police to get to the scene of where this was all happening. I mean, presumably that has complicated the medical response.
Yeah, that's true. The patients that we've admitted, 5 of them we received within the first hour. And the last patient we received within 3 hours, something like that. So, of course, there might have been patients that would have been salvageable that we couldn't reach because of the ongoing life-threatening violence.
And I just wonder how far, you know, the hospital is able to cope with this number of casualties and the type of injuries that they have sustained.
We have a university hospital with many hundreds of beds, so we could quickly really free up services for surgery, services for intensive care, and also hospital beds.
Are you able to give me any details as to whether the patients are all adults?
Yeah, all were adults.
Just in terms of what now for the medical staff and the medical response more broadly? How far is there going to be a question of trying to get support to those who maybe need emotional or mental help?
That is very true. That is our major challenge now. There are so many people that have been touched by this traumatic incident. It's for many of the people in Örebro, this is really something life-changing. We have never seen violence like this before. So now we're focusing on actually acute crisis support, you could say, for the many people that have been touched by this.
Jonas Claesson, Head of Health Services in Örebro. At a news conference in Stockholm, the Swedish Prime Minister Ulf Kristersson said the authorities were still looking for answers as to what had happened.
Vi har idag sett ett brutalt...
Today we have seen brutal, deadly violence committed against completely innocent people. This is the worst mass shooting in Sweden's history. We are still looking for many answers, and I don't have those answers for you either. But there will come a time when we know what happened, how it could have happened, and what the motives behind it may have been.
Nina Hjelmgren is a journalist who grew up in Örebro and was a professor at the university there. She's currently in southern eastern Sweden. How has she viewed the events of the day?
Tim, this entire afternoon, this story, when it unfolded, has been like a nightmare. First, you wouldn't believe what you heard, and then you had to believe what you heard, and then the news that five people were taken to the hospital, and then it was six. And then later, many hours later, at the press conference at local time, 6 o'clock, the police declared that 10 people were dead. That means that there had to be dead bodies laying around in the school too. It was horrendous. And also this school, there was a lockdown, and there were numerous schools surrounding it, and they were under lockdown too for hours during the whole afternoon before, you know, they could clear and go home.
So
nightmare,
indeed. And so one can imagine that along with the death and the physical injury and the terror, I mean, there will be an awful lot of very traumatized people, many of them young people, who are going to have to deal with the aftermath of all this.
Absolutely. And I mean, this is not only affecting people living in Örebro. I've said it before. I believe this is one of those days that will affect the soul of Sweden. This is not just for Örebro. This is for the whole country. Because what has happened in Örebro today is not Sweden, even though it happened in Sweden.
What do you mean?
And we don't understand why.
Yeah. But what do you mean when you say that it will affect the soul of Sweden, if it is because such an aberration?
Because this injury that it has done to so many people, the harm it has done to so many people, it has affected everybody in their hearts, and we don't understand why. And this is one of the big things now that all the journalists and so forth, everybody has to try to find out a motive, because we're totally confused and hurting, because this is violence that is unheard of.
The Swedish journalist and professor Nina Hjelmgren. Spain is coming to the end of its olive harvesting season. In 2021, the world's biggest producer of olive oil began suffering a punishing drought. Production plummeted, and the price of what's been called the country's liquid gold soared. The 2024-2025 olive season has been better in Spain, but farmers are still watching the sky. And apart from climate change, there's another cause for anxiety. Xylella fastidiosa is a deadly and hard-to-detect bacterium which has killed millions of olive trees in southern Italy. In Cordoba, Spain, Dr. Blanca Landa heads an international project at the Institute of Sustainable Agriculture dedicated to stopping the spread of the microbe. Linda Presley met her at her laboratory.
It's a biosecurity facility, a quarantine level 2 facility. So the sluice is under positive pressure. It's to avoid any escape from the laboratory inside or some entrance from outside from the street.
Inside, Dr. Lander and her team keep a collection of deadly strains of the Xylella microbe.
It's considered one of the most dangerous quarantine pathogens, and this is due to the huge number of diseases that can cause in very important crops such as olive, almonds, grapevines.
And the big fear, of course, especially here in Andalusia, is the olive industry.
Only in Andalusia, we have over 1.6 million olive hectares, so you can imagine the concern of the olive industry.
Xylella kills slowly, clogging the vessels through which a plant absorbs water. And the only way it spreads is through insect vectors. They feed on an infected tree, then carry the microbes to the next tree they land on. It's believed Xylella first arrived in Europe in ornamental coffee plants from Latin America. Dr. Lander remembers her first sight of the havoc wreaked by the killer bacterium when she visited southern Italy in 2014.
I was completely astonished. So it was like being in a film of like atomic war or whatever, because all the trees were completely died and drying. So all the Puglia, all the area is affected.
The dying trees generated conspiracy theories. Scientists, an oil pipeline, large companies, even the mafia, all of them were blamed for the demise of countless olive groves. Farmers were distraught, chaining themselves to their ancient, diseased trees to prevent the environmental authorities from removing them, the only way to counter Xylella.
It was a very, very sad situation. They said, some of the farmers, to me, that they take care of the trees even better than their own child, you know, because it was their way of living. Everywhere you go, you see symptoms of Xylella everywhere, yeah.
And have they managed to stop it yet?
No, not at all, no.
Italy's lost more than 20 million olive trees to Xylella, and it's been detected in parts of Spain too, although not yet in Andalusia, which is why Dr. Lander's research is critical. In a large, secured industrial greenhouse, she keeps plant material that her team's infected with Xylella, including 11 varieties of olives.
What we do, we inoculate artificially, trying to simulate what the insect does, that is using a very thin needle. We inject a suspension of the bacterium in the trunk of the plants.
Okay.
So we don't work with insect vectors. It's too dangerous.
Especially if those insects escaped. There's still so much that's mysterious about the bacterium. Dr. Lander knows the plants in her greenhouse are infected, but none are so far showing symptoms.
We don't know when something happens in the plant that trigger the symptoms development. And when you notice, it's too late because it appears and it happens very fast.
And you don't know whether it's young trees or old trees, or do you know which ones are more vulnerable?
Normally, the older trees are more sensitive.
Part of the end game would be to develop olive varieties resistant to Xylella.
Second approach is to inoculate the plants, for instance, with the beneficial communities of microorganisms that can protect the plant of not getting infected.
And then there are efforts to attack Xylella itself.
We have some collaborators in the project that are searching for viruses that can infect the bacterium.
I asked Dr. Lander if the gravity of her research project gives her sleepless nights.
No, I mean, otherwise I won't sleep any day, but sometimes I had been very, very concerned, especially when we detected the bacterium in Spain.
So is it a question of when, not if, in terms of the olives in southern Spain?
I don't think that is a matter of when. I will be optimistic. Now we are more prepared than before. We know exactly how to monitor our territory. I think farmers now are aware of what can be the problem.
Dr. Blanca Lander, ending that report from Linda Presley on in Cordoba in southern Spain on the problems facing Europe's olive harvests. You're listening to NewsHour. It's live from the BBC. This is NewsHour, live from the BBC, with me, Tim Franks. We're close to the third anniversary of Russia's war in Ukraine, with a sense that the shape of the war may change under the new US administration. Russia is pushing hard to capture more territory. It now controls about a sixth of Ukraine and is continuing a slow, grinding advance on the Eastern Front. The city of Pokrovsk, a key supply and transport hub, is in Russia's sights. Its forces are now only 2 kilometres away. Our senior international correspondent, Ola Guerin, reports now on the emptying of another Ukrainian city.
We're driving towards Pokrovsk, a frontline city, and along the road I can see damaged houses, areas that have been bombed. Just passing another flattened building now. We're travelling in an armoured car with a volunteer organisation called Base UA. They carry out evacuations, getting civilians out of harm's way.
My name is Anton Yaremchuk. I'm active here in the East since the very first days of the invasion.
Tell me what the mission is for today.
We're going to Pokrovsk. The city is basically on the front line. It's been heavily attacked day and night. There are around 7,000 people still in the city. So we'll try to get some people out of that nightmare.
We've stopped now at the first address on the team's list for today. They're not sure if the woman living here will be willing to evacuate, but they're going to try. We've been hearing explosions in the last few minutes. Anton climbs over a locked gate to check the house, but there's no one home. A few streets away, he finds 71-year-old Olga, wrapped up in a winter coat with a furry hood, already waiting by the road. Olga has just left her house. She's come out and got into the van. Olga, what has the situation been like here? How frightening has it been?
It's not life anymore. It's like being in hell.
How long has this been your home? How long have you lived here?
I've been in this house for 65 years. My children grew up here. My grandchildren. It's been a long time.
It must be very hard to leave.
You know, in the beginning it seemed possible. We thought we'll sit it out. Maybe it'll be okay. But already the ground is shaking. And it seems to be that it's dangerous to stay here.
Pokrovsk is coming under heavy Russian attack, bombing, shelling. Today is extremely cold, snowy. There's fog. Visibility is very poor. That's actually good for the evacuation team. It means that they'll be less visible to Russian drones.
Добрий день. Евакуація безкоштовна.
Along the way, whenever Anton spots a civilian, he urges them to go. There'll be street battles, I promise you. He warns a group of three who have been collecting water. I'm doing this from the very first day, he says. It's the same everywhere. This is the final stage. The last pickup of the day is 75-year-old Luba, who looks bereft and flinches at every explosion we hear. What has the situation been like in the last few days and few weeks?
It's been bad. Bad. We've been left alone under the clear sky. There are no authorities here, just nothing. People are getting killed under the sky. There is no gas, no water, just nothing. We've been abandoned. Everyone has abandoned us.
There's a lot of speculation that President Donald Trump may try and get peace talks going. When you look ahead, what do you imagine for 2025?
To be honest, I also stopped looking too much ahead. I personally don't think that even if some kind of negotiations will start, they will bring a ceasefire anytime soon. I'm sure that even if they do start, there will be a massive intensification on the battlefield, obviously trying to gain leverage for both parties. So this is the reality we're facing, and I'm really not expecting it to be over anytime soon.
The words of Anton Yaremchuk from the volunteer rescue group Base UA. He was ending that report from Ola Guerin. Since Ola travelled to Pokrovsk, Anton's team has come under attack there from a Russian drone. It was an attack which left a British volunteer severely injured. He lost an arm and a leg, but is in stable condition now. His name is Eddie Scott. He's been speaking to the BBC from his hospital bed and described what happened.
We entered Pokrovsk, which was the town we're working in, so mid-morning, like 10 minutes before we exited the town. There's two people on bikes, civilians, so we opened the door to give them evacuation leaflets. At that point, I heard a drone. 30 seconds later, there was a mighty bang explosion right in front of my face. I tried putting the car into gear, and my left leg just wasn't doing anything. I tried turning the wheel, and I could feel my shoulder moving. I could see my arm on the wheel not moving. And it was at that point I was like, okay, this is bad. This is really bad. And I looked down and just saw my left leg was just absolutely shredded. I won't go into too much detail about that, but yeah, it was bad. And then my team lead came around to my side of the vehicle, pulled me out, got a tourniquet on me, saved my life. We were in a white armored vehicle with evacuation and volunteer written very clearly on it. It was absolutely zero doubt as to who we are, what we were doing. By making it very clear, this was a war crime.
Eddie Scott speaking to the BBC, and Anton's group Base UA have now suspended evacuations from the city of Pokrovsk for the time being, though evacuations, we're told by police volunteers, are continuing. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Tim Franks, and the rest of the team here in London, thanks for your company.
Yoga is more than just exercise. It's the spiritual practice that millions swear by. And in 2017, Miranda, a university tutor from London, joins a yoga school that promises profound transformation.
It felt a really safe and welcoming space. After the yoga classes, I felt amazing.
But soon, that calm, welcoming atmosphere leads to something far darker, a journey that leads to allegations of grooming, trafficking and exploitation across international borders.
I don't have my passport, I don't have my phone, I don't have my bank cards, I have nothing.
The passport being taken, the being in a house and not feeling like they can leave.
World of Secrets is where untold stories are unveiled and hidden realities are exposed. In this new series, we're confronting the dark side of the wellness industry, where the hope of a spiritual breakthrough gives way to disturbing accusations.
You just get sucked in so gradually, and it's done so skillfully that you don't realise.
And it's like this, the secret that's there.
I wanted to believe that, you know, that whatever they were doing, even if it seemed gross to me, was for some spiritual reason that I couldn't yet understand.
Revealing the hidden secrets of a global yoga network.
I feel that I have no other choice. The only thing I can do is to speak about this and to put my reputation and everything else on the line. I want truth and justice. And for other people to not be hurt. for things to be different in the future.
To bring it into the light and almost alchemize some of that evil stuff that went on and take back the power.
World of Secrets, Season 6, The Bad Guru. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.